It's the 40s and 50s was actually the era where the film was established. The actors and the writers and the directors, I mean, they did always something different and new. And when you look at the actors and compare them to nowadays, in those days, especially in the 40s, 50s, maybe in the 60s, actors had less scandals out there, and they behaved different. And, you know, it was more a pleasure. And I think we look more up to those actors and directors than in nowadays. I think when I look at actors like Cary Grant or Cary Cooper or Grace Kelly or Marilyn Monroe, all those people, Jack Lemmon in the 50s, or then those John Waynes, they had more class. I think it was way more class than in nowadays. Nowadays, everything is so normal and so, I don't, nothing special anymore. The film industry, they still had ideas. I think that's gone too. I personally love the 40s, 50s a lot more than the 90s or 2000s or afterwards. Everything was a little more cheesy, I guess. That was another part. I think everything was a little overdone. Like when they were excited or when they cried or emotions, everything was a little overdone. And I think that made it more special too, because it gave you a feeling more like you were in a theater and you were enjoying the moment, the time. And nothing was really 100% real somehow. Yeah, that's just how I see it somehow. It's I wish it would come back a little bit.
Right, and welcome to the show. Jay Ledbetter is with us tonight, folks. How are you, sir?
I am doing very well. Excited to talk about some of these older movies this evening. It's exciting. It's always fun to talk about that stuff.
1000%. I just figured when we were going to start with, you know, all the various eras and just kind of group them, is like kind of just do a casual summary of what really truly appealed in every part of the era. I think suffice it to say, you know, just like many people, I'm definitely a huge fan of Humphrey Bogart and Alfred Hitchcock's works. And there's plenty of, you know, we're coming right off of, again, you know, the 20s, which was silent film for the most part, and 30s was introducing Technicolor late in the game and period pieces. And it's just interesting how, you know, by the 40s, you know, you're still just doing a lot of B pictures, and 50s are embracing a lot of sci-fi and B movies, you know, like the original The Thing, The Forbidden Planet. And, you know, just at this point, you know, like everything you see now in today's cinema, you know, it's like what they were, you know, everyone likes to instantly associate it with the 80s and 90s, but it's like, but they're all going off of what was pioneered in the 40s and 50s, definitely.
Right. But the other thing about the 40s and 50s, we are firmly in the middle of like the code era. The Hays Code is alive and strong. Code. Content is, you know, there's censorship going on. So you're not going to see the sex scenes and stuff that you see in those movies from the 80s and 90s. There's stuff. Every movie that got made had to go through the government, and they said what you had to take out or change. Or at least American films, that is. And yeah. I know there are some fantastic foreign films as well, whether they be Britain or other parts of Europe or Japan or whatever. But Hollywood films were in this weird spot at the time where it was like, you know, that kiss was 2 seconds too long. You need to change that. So it's just a wild time kind of in the history of art, really, but especially in American movie making.
1,000%, because we're having to endure a lot of war movies, which are either, you know, pro-war.
Oh yes, a lot of propaganda films.
Fun escapism, and some of them are, like you say, very distracting today, because you're just like, yeah, there's really isn't any entertainment value in this. And there's others which is like, it's fun, but you do have to get through probably 10 minutes of flag waving to get to the actual essence of the film. It's like required to put that in there at that time. And yeah, I mean, it's also interesting seeing how what slurs they could say versus,
you know, well, yes, there's certainly some problematic elements of some of these films.
This is like, you watch some of those Batman serials and you're like, whoa, some pretty non-friendly language towards yellow people.
But yeah, I mean, even in some great classic films, there's stuff for you to be like, yeah, it was, you know, that's what they said, that's what they did at the time. I don't know. I can't really defend it, but you just got to go with it, because the rest of it is just so incredible.
Right. Well, what are you going to do? What can I change? You know, since they were ignorant at that time. how were you introduced into those kinds of movies? Were you watching them often on Turner Classic Movies and antenna channels, or were you was it reinforced in your household growing up?
Yeah, I don't know that I didn't really grow up in a movie house, right? Okay, I mean, gotcha. I will say this: when I was growing up, I wasn't allowed to see like PG-13 movies until I was 13. It was like content was very monitored at my house. It was like you have very specific things that you are allowed to watch, and that is what you will watch. Now, in that regard, it was like my mom is very nostalgic for like the 60s, 70s, 50s kind of just idea of life, that kind of sentimental. It's almost like my mom, if you ask my mom, she'd probably be like, yeah, Hays Code, good. I like it a lot. And I'm like, oh, one of the worst things that's ever happened to art. but she would be like, yeah, it's great. You know, I don't want to see all this stuff. I remember a couple of years ago, I was like, yeah, I watched, you know, this many new releases this year. And she was just like, I'm worried about you. I know the way that movies are made today, and I just don't want you seeing that stuff. And I was like,
for God's sake,
promise you I'm all right. I'm all good. But as far as those, this era of movies go, and this is not necessarily 40s or 50s, but like Sound of Music was something that played in my house a lot. But it wasn't like we were watching a lot of the movies that we're going to talk about today, which I think a lot of my favorites do have kind of subversive tendencies to them, where they were really trying to figure out ways to get around the Hays Code or were code. But I kind of just came to these on my own. This is not really kind of ingrained in me from my childhood or anything.
1,000%. It took me a while to even realize that there were actually director's cuts of The Last Sleep and Touch of Evil, for instance. And I was like, but those are way better because you're getting the full picture. And even though they can't show you, you know, full violence or, you know, and there's some grim material, it still is like that. There's a reason they appeal to more people, is because they're kind of like the various like pulp novels, or some of them to some extent are a little trashy, but they're very good in that they're allowing for just a lot of creativity and suspense. And I mean, the 30s definitely had a lot of underground movies, and I think they blend very well into the 40s in that you're having to market stars and
all about the stars,
right? And the musicals, I think, that have stayed with us have been often a lot of just ones that have a lot of other kind of contacts to them, and just double entendres. And when you get to the 50s, you're still in kind of just hard-boiled noirs and just character studies and
westerns,
even some occasional political thrillers, which is interesting. It's just Frank Capra's movies. It's hard to believe that they most of them bombed at the time with such leading, you know, men and women that were in his movies. And you're just like, but they're just so treasured now. And you're just like, what, were they just poorly marketed at the time, or were they a little too progressive? What was it?
Yeah. You go back and look at the box office of the era. And a lot of times you're just like, I've never heard of this movie. I have no idea what this is, because the directors who are remembered from that time, the Capras, the Howard Hawks, a lot of times their movies just didn't do well. But a lot of those movies are now considered stone cold classics. So it just goes to show you, you know, maybe some people are like, man, I hate that Transformers is the most popular movie or whatever. It's like, you know what? History will smile upon the other films, and probably not Transformers, because that's how it's been for many, many decades.
1,000%. And it's kind of like with music. If you don't want to support it, literally your vote counts. By not feeding the beast, by not paying it any attention, it will kind of subtract out of the equation, and you will, you know, be treated to a lot of the content that you are looking for. And 50s, it is interesting just seeing just how many kinds of detective tropes are get carried over into the 60s and 70s. And you know, you see people like even Sidney Lumet making his impact here, you know, with like, you know, A Few Good Men, not A Few Good Men, 12 Angry Men.
Yeah.
And is like Murder for the Prosecution. A few of those other ones are just so key. It's like, yeah, you see them referenced everywhere now. And it's just so interesting when you can see kind of a pot boiler, and that reminds you of a good book that you read years ago. And you're kind of seeing a segment of it on screen. To Kill a Mockingbird is just still constantly referenced, because you're dealing with just very, and it seems like those were like the only ways you could talk about just racial or, you know, adultery or anything else that was just, you know, not, no go for kids.
You kind of had to wrap all of it in a feel good blanket, right?
Yeah.
Like, you can throw like, It's a Wonderful Life, obviously very uplifting movie, also really dark, really dark.
Extremely dark. And yeah. I have people who even want to see it every year. And I'm like, I was good watching it 3 years in a row. I can't do it anymore. It's the kind of...
I watch it every year. I bawl my eyes out. I saw it in a movie theater last year. What an experience. Nice. It was incredible. On 35 millimeter. Oh, it was just fantastic. I loved it.
Just very
beautiful. My wife absolutely bawled her eyes out, because we had just found out that she was pregnant, so her hormones were raging, and she was like crying because she knew that she was about to cry. It was like a pre-cry, and she was a mess, and I was too. That movie's incredible, but I do love those kind of, you know, ways of getting around the content provisions that they had to follow. I think is so great, and just a great movie star, Jimmy Stewart, man.
Yep, he has a lot of hidden westerns and other fun comedies, and it is kind of cool just seeing just how many other movies you can kind of just lift out of here that still constantly get played on MGM HD or Turner Classic. And you see so many of them who it's like they're associated with the work now, but everyone had realized they were kind of ignored back in the day for these hard efforts. Like, you know, Robert Mitchum has a lot of war and horror thrillers, and it's interesting too, even seeing how Lauren Bacall just kind of becomes one of the best known you know, serious actresses. She's and at that point, yeah, a lot of everyone has to work even so hard. Like, the A and B list is just so apparent in this day, in this particular era, is like, who are the ones who were kind of B-listers who slowly rose to A-list stardom, and which were the ones who were kind of starlets but slowly trying to become serious actresses, you know?
Well, you know what I kind of think about this era is I think about the huge movie stars, and I think there's a real difference between being a great actor and being a great movie star sometimes. I don't know that Humphrey Bogart is like a great actor.
Yeah.
I don't think he's very versatile.
He's not,
you know, he kind of just does his thing, but his thing freaking works. I will tell you that much. Same with like John Wayne. you know, those guys who are just like, they have a lane and they have mastered that lane and it works. But I don't know that they're not great actors, if that makes sense.
No, that's exactly it. It's kind of like, you know, what's the difference between, say, a George Clooney and a Denzel Washington? You know, George Clooney has the looks and the movie star look, and Denzel kind of has a lot of range. And
yeah.
So you definitely get a lot of these here. And then, yeah, people like Bogart are interesting in that they want to escape, but that's all that, you know, once you, typecasting is even worse back then. You know, he's having to survive cancer, and this is like, yeah, this is like, he pretty much saves his best for his last with like The Higher They Fall. And, but yeah, there's a bunch of other ones where basically he just shows up basically to, you know, say one line and shoot someone. And
yeah,
when you see it nowadays, when you see an A-lister in a awful movie nowadays, often we just kind of forget about it. We're just like, oh yeah, they were in that, weren't they? You know, they were an uncredited voiceover, but they were
during this time everybody was in like 5 movies a year. They were just under contract and they were working
that they were slaving away doing this. And now is like, in today's era, everyone does like 2 to 4 movies a year and or a giant TV show,
if that. Yeah, Leonardo DiCaprio will do a movie every 3 years. And he's kind of the closest thing we have to one of those old movie stars, but he just picks and chooses his work much more patiently than they did back then.
It is interesting because this is like the producers of today are kind of going off of trends that were established in older Hollywood. And yet at the same time, they kind of want to branch out. And, you know, we didn't have the internet in this era where everyone could instantly look on Twitter is like, what's currently trending now? I can market a whole movie based on that whole gimmick. You know, it's like, here, you know, you got, again, giant billboards and posters and newspapers. And yeah, it's like actors, unfortunately, are not producers at this time. They are, again, the basically treated no better than, say, prostitutes or circus freaks. And so they're having to slowly gain some kind of respect. And this is where I think the Academy Awards start taking off. You start seeing the Hollywood Walk of Fame becoming a thing.
I mean, film criticism, I think, improves during this time too. But it's like, I'm on my podcast, we're doing a Howard Hawks movie series right now. Oh, and I'm sweet. Reading a Howard Hawks book.
Oh.
And it's like, you know, I read, this movie cost $400,000 and it made $1.2 million, a massive blockbuster. And it's like, oh my God, it only made like 3 times its budget today. That would be like a disaster. And it's just
right.
Blockbusters in that way did not really exist. And I mean, there were Howard Hawks films were not ever really the highest grossing films of the year or anything, but it's just interesting to see how modest success was for films back then, especially compared to today, where it's like this one movie just takes over the culture, but only for like 2 or 3 weeks now because of the internet. Everything just comes and goes so quickly. Whereas these movies, it's like, yeah, it opened up to 100,000 and it ended up making 1.5 million over months and months and months. Just a very interesting time compared to today culturally, just how all this stuff works. You know, you weren't going to get spoilers on Twitter in the 1940s. You could see the movie in a month and a half, right? It's just just very different times.
Oh, 1,000%. That is a good point, because it's like, yeah, if movies came out of this, yeah, you heard about them over the radio and you're like, that sounds interesting. I might go see that tonight with, you know,
yeah,
my date. And it's because they either didn't broadcast anything and I, you know, miss the tele or radio cast or whatever. And, or the distributor pulled it after 2 weeks and it got sent to the, you know, one of the free channels at that time, you know, 3 years later. And it is funny how, yeah, it's like, if a movie bombs, you unfortunately, you really do hear about it. And, you know, they had the paparazzi, but a lot of it could be very hush hush and rumor based you know, before we started bringing journalists into question and everything, is like, now if someone has an unprofessional film set, that person never works again and we hear all about it. You know, it's just,
yeah, you could be a little tyrannical, back then for sure.
Oh yeah. And this is before we're figuring out, you know, proper, you know, unions and work rights. So there would be plenty of
films. Yeah, this is early stages of at least, because I've been reading this Howard Hawks book. This is early years of the Directors Union, at least. And he was one of the kind of main forces behind that, although he was less interested in the union part than what it could specifically get him. Which is interesting. That's kind of Howard Hawks' whole deal. He was like, what's best for me in this instance? And in that instance, it was being in the union.
Although so, that is a good parallel to today's world, because like we'll see all the time now if like we find out a scandal about a celebrity who was a dishonest mascot for a company, or you know,
yeah,
says they believe
that. Oh yeah, yeah. So the more things change, the more they stay the same, right?
Right. This is like, so you were the poster child, but you never really believed in this anyway. So now this product means nothing because got to get a new mascot. And it's, yeah, Hawks is definitely, I mean, the fury you see in all his kinds of moody lighting and movies as a whole is like, now that you filled me in on that, is like, I buy it.
Yeah.
The beasts that he unleashed in his movies, and the crime wave of cops and robbers and cowboys and, you know, outlaws.
And also just how his movies are about people being really good at their jobs a lot of the time. And he's like, I want to be really good at my job and then get paid for it. That's what's most important for me, right?
Yeah.
He wasn't really precious about his work, but he was like, I want full control. Just let me do what I do and pay me and I'll make another movie for you. That's what I'm about.
Right, whether it's a acclaimed, you know, period piece or a kick-ass western for the B crowd,
he made like goofy farces, and that's what a lot of directors did during this time. I was like, okay, this script is currently in front of me, I'm going to make it because that is what you hired me to do.
Oh, totally. When I watch his work, I essentially just feel like he basically was like, I'm gonna echo Fritz Lang's, you know, attention to detail, and then I'm gonna just, you know, and just do a pulp novel. I'm going to do, you know, whatever is just can showcase an actor just playing a real badass, you know, character I want to know more about. And anytime you see any of his movies, yeah, it's like you'll see him do, yeah, like Free a Year, and like maybe a third of them were well known and the others were obscure. And you're like,
I've watched, I'm sorry to keep directing the conversation to Howard Hawks. He's front of mind for me right now, but yeah, I've watched like 25 Howard Hawks movies in the last like 2 months, so it's basically all I think about these days.
Hey, nice.
Well, what are some of your favorites of this era though? Like what are your like Mount Rushmore of the 40s and 50s kind of movies?
I mean, obviously you got to check out Vertigo and Rear Window, but I mean, hey, Forbidden Planet for me is just like essential sci-fi.
Yeah.
Because like that, you see just so many others do it nowadays, and they're just trying to imitate, you know, just Twilight Zone or Star Trek, but in the worst possible way. And you're just like, just go back to the Forbidden Planet thing, where you just have just very moody, like the title planet is kind of the character, and everyone else is kind of along for the ride. Like I saw some movies recently, like Ad Astra, kind of try to redo that, and I'm like,
no. Apocalypse Now in space, yes.
You're right. And it's just like, there's so many other movies that unfortunately, like the 50s, part of how to sell it was, you know, hire some animators to put it on the film reel. And unfortunately, we're kind of spoiled now with digital. So when someone does a movie now, they often just, again, they focus too much on the effects, and you instantly can tell that it's been rewritten too many times because there's just so many.
Yeah, it's so much the Jurassic Park thing of like, we spent so much time thinking about whether we could do it and not whether we should do it. And that kind of stuff, it just handicaps so many movies these days because they're like, how big can we make this thing? And it's like, start with the small stuff first. That's the most important.
Yeah, and it wrecks the good movies for us too, because we're just like, yeah, but had this good movie that I watch all the time not come out, I wouldn't have all these other awful, you know, Star Wars type knockoffs. Yeah. And there's even other movies that sometimes try to be like Fifth Element, and once again they're just like that, they're trying too hard to be a cult movie or play with everyone's head. You see some of them where it's like the last few horror murder mysteries I saw were kind of more like just a very bad giallo, where you're just like, okay, but
yeah, that's big right now, kind of copying giallo films.
Totally. And it's like, well, if you're gonna do a giallo right, you really gotta have just some really just very interconnected suspense, instead they're kind of also imitating a lot of the 90s slashers where just end it randomly and on a cliffhanger, and you're just like, what on earth did I just watch?
Hey, you gotta leave room for a sequel.
That was part of the marketing crowd. Oh, well, it feels like an afterthought.
Oh, I mean, that's these days, that's part of the pitch, is how can we sequelize it? How can we turn this into a franchise? How can we turn this into a spinoff TV show? That's a huge part of it, which was not a thing in the 40s and 50s. And they were also just far more patient films. The viewers were accustomed to a very different pace as far as these movies were concerned. And it's a pace that I, for the most part, enjoy more, which is just like, we're living with these characters. We don't need an action sequence every 15 minutes. It's about the people and the story and the themes of the film. And I appreciate that so much about so many of these films. And
yeah. And nowadays I will see a period piece and it just makes me cringe, because half the time you're seeing talented filmmakers and you're seeing money on the screen, but you're like, okay, I get that film homage. That's a High Noon shot. That's a, a John Ford, you know, wagon train kind of shot. Mm-hmm. But then there's other moments where it's like, again, yeah, it's like, I know you're trying to be so bigger, or you're just trying to make the scene work. But there are other times where it's like, yeah, I just need to go back and just watch a classic black and white movie.
And that is another thing too, where it's like, in the 40s and 50s, these people are making the things for the first time that now they're trying to like recreate. So this is like the origin of all of cinema, which is awesome, because, you know, we had the silent films in the 20s. They were kind of figuring it out in the 30s with talkies. And then in the 40s, we're just off and running. 50s, we start seeing some color. This is kind of the origin of a lot of the things that we love about movies today.
1,000%. And whenever you're seeing people talk about dangerous stuff, it's like, well, these movies were back before there was anything known as safety regulations, you know,
horses
get killed on these movies. And let's not forget about the fact that, again, someone, you know, we didn't have a Steadicam necessarily set up, you know, except for like a small studio.
No, they're making that stuff up on the fly as far as like new techniques. It's crazy.
They're having to get inside an actual helicopter and follow around, not knowing, you know, how close to be to the ground. And it's, you know, you can thank all the various casualties for why people can now do movies.
Yeah, you know, it's not great. It's not great, but no. They made some good movies.
They did make some good movies. And I remember even just reading like about a 2000s blockbuster, and the director wanted to remove like a stuntman who had died doing a dangerous stunt. I was like, are you kidding me? It's like, so I think we do also kind of, it's easy to get a little more callous nowadays, since everything, we have so many shortcuts in order to make something, and so many other studio hands and investors to answer to now. And it's like,
yeah,
these movies weren't necessarily worried about marketing outside of the States. They were kind of just pretty much, they had their own modus operandi and own, they decided when fees were due and well, when to time their output.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but what are some other ones you would introduce like many crowds to, where you're just like, this is a mandatory once a year, just film appreciation, let's do a month of this.
I mean, for me, my favorite filmmakers, it's a filmmaking duo from this era, some of my favorite filmmakers ever, Michael Powell and Emmerich Pressburger. Powell and Pressburger, the Archers, as they were known.
Nice.
They've just made, I think they made four masterpieces in the 1940s. They use like the Technicolor techniques. Their films are absolutely gorgeous. My favorite film of theirs is A Matter of Life and Death, which is just like, it goes back and forth between black and white and color. Although it does this really interesting thing where like the afterlife is actually in black and white, and then the real world is in color, as kind of this way of reaffirming existence on Earth. And it's this very metaphysical story about, you know, trying to figure out what it means to be alive and why it's important to be alive and take advantage of the time that you do have. And also the, yeah, you know, like the value of what this life in the physical realm means. And it's such an incredible movie with some incredible sequences, some of the best set design you'll ever see. It's crazy good. Have you ever seen that movie?
I have not, but they've been on my to watch list.
Powell and Pressburger, those are my guys.
And I have heard the Archer's Tour every once in a while. I even hear a cinematographer use that term, and everyone, like maybe a quarter of those people get that. I'm like, for real? Okay.
I mean, their most famous movie is Martin Scorsese's favorite film ever made, which that's a great endorsement if you can get that. That is
a great endorsement.
The Red Shoes. Scorsese actually owns the Red Shoes from the film. And honestly, there is a ballet sequence in that film that might be the best 20 minutes of film that anyone has ever done ever. It is like unbelievable how good it is.
It's on HBO Max if anyone wants it.
It's on HBO Max. They just came out with the 4K Criterion that I bought. It looks incredible.
Nice.
And the other two films from the 40s from them that I love, and they made several other movies too that I like, but the two that I love are The Life and Death of Colonel Blimp, which I think is the greatest World War II film from the British perspective.
Oh, nice.
And then additionally, a film called Black Narcissus, which is about this nunnery. It's one of those movies in the 40s where you're like, wow, this is uncomfortably sexy. I don't understand what's going on here. This is weird. it's wonderful, and again, an absolutely gorgeous film. So if you want one recommendation from the 40s and 50s for me, it is to go watch the films of the Archers. They are my favorites from this era.
For sure. And I take it you've also seen their take on Stairway to Heaven.
Oh, that's a Matter of Life and Death. That was the other name for it.
Oh shit. Okay. Perfect.
Yeah, that was I can't remember where it was. I think now it's A Matter of Life and Death. I don't know. That seems to be the most common title now. But Stairway to Heaven was the title either in America at the time or in Britain at the time or whatever it was. But yeah, that's A Matter of Life and Death. Again, my favorite of theirs. That's probably one of my 10 favorite movies ever made.
Nice. And do you think they're becoming better known now, aside from just whatever filmmaker mentions them casually in an interview, just because these movies have been remastered a few times and are in the vault somewhere?
I mean, I think The Red Shoes for sure is just one of those movies that is going to be remembered forever. I think that is like in the canon. It's, you know, stone cold classic for the history of time. I do wonder just in general, those movies are coming up on 100 years old. I mean, they're 80 years old right now. Do normal people, not weirdos like you and me, do they watch these? I don't think they do, which is a bummer.
They do. I think they watch like whatever made it to like the 1001 movies list, which is annoying because you like to think.
I mean, I'm sure a couple of these are on there.
They might be. But I like to think that it's more than just whatever made a list. You would like to think that, you know, libraries and even just thrift stores have a lot of these goodies, you know, just lying around there on occasion, as opposed
to...
It's
cute that you think that people still go to libraries. I'll give you that.
Some do, but yeah, there's been a minuscule amount. There's some who still don't have internet.
It's Netflix. I mean, it's streaming. And I will say, to HBO Max's credit, yeah, they have a lot of those TCM classic films. I wish they would kind of push them more to the forefront, just from a film history standpoint. But financially for them, it's not in their best interest to do that stuff, because that's not what gets people to subscribe to your streaming service.
Right. And
except for a Criterion Channel.
That and hell, even just maybe just Kino Lorber does a pretty good job just remastering a lot of these.
Yeah, there's some companies doing some incredible work, some incredible preservation of film history, and I appreciate the hell out of them for doing that.
A lot of them pretty much just stay in their zone. Like Shout Factory will do a lot of bizarre 80s cult hits, and
yeah, they do like
does a lot of the slasher
Joe Dante from the 70s. Movies or whatever. Yeah,
yep, Joe Dante for sure. And it is interesting how, for a while, filmmakers in the age of DVD would endorse certain titles, so-and-so presents, you know, and
isn't
a thing as much anymore now that everyone wants to choose between physical or streaming, depending on how much money they got to shell out.
Yeah, I'm firmly in the physical camp. I gotta say, I'm staring at my DVD or my Blu-ray shelves right now.
Especially if you're doing, like, research for the... a show is like, yeah, I'm gonna need, you know,
yeah, all the supplementary materials and yeah, stuff like that. Yeah, that's huge. It's a huge asset.
The movie three different times, each time with a different film historian commentary.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh man, and it is cool to just kind of see, like you said, just who put the care into reintroducing the movie. Like before they were doing official late night screenings, everyone was kind of doing a let's do a movie club, you know, but like a book club.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's weird to think about how many movies just don't exist anymore. Like, you can't go find them. Even some movies that were pretty big at the time, it's just, you know, that film doesn't last forever, and if there is not a great deal of demand to remaster that film, it's gonna decay and go away. It's just gone, which is crazy to think about.
Yeah. There's some movies that unfortunately I see when I see them come on the movie channels, they do look like they used like the worst possible VHS rip they could find. Like, that's just
I mean, this is outside of the 40s and 50s. One of my favorite comedies of all time, which is Elaine May's The Heartbreak Kid.
Oh.
One of my favorite movies ever. I've only seen it in like a crappy DVD rip because apparently the distribution rights sit with some like pharmaceutical company who doesn't give a crap one way or the other if it gets remastered ever. So like, we're not going to go to the trouble to like give those rights to anybody. I don't even know where it is. It's probably in,
oh wow,
in my shed or whatever. And wow, that's just crazy to think about. That's a big movie. People love that movie.
That's happened with some movies featured on Elvira and Mr. Science Theater, even, where they're like, who owns it? Some bizarre, you know, family in Wisconsin. Yeah. They know damn well they can make money off it, but they want to be dicks. And they're like, you will only get the rights to this broadcast when literally we die. But that's unlikely to happen because the next, you know, heir to the throne will also, you know, cock block any attempts to.
Yeah, this is in my will that the next of kin will also block the distribution rights for this film.
Why even bother? And then Roger that. It does get annoying when some, you know, the time comes to try and remaster something, and once again the studios will get annoyed if they see a bootleg of it on like Daily Motion or YouTube, and it's like, then release it.
Yeah.
Oh, we don't want to.
Yeah, exactly.
But there's we're losing money.
There are Robert Altman movies that I can't buy. The only place to see them probably is on YouTube, and that probably gets taken down every other day. So it's, yeah,
1,000%. There are some filmmakers who even don't want you to see some of their earlier movies, but they know damn well, you know, if I got a fanboy.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. Yeah.
And so I think you have summed up just like the 40s and 50s, if any. So how many snobs have you encountered who just like refuse to watch anything in black and white? I've already had to just ignore anyone who just like won't do subtitles or anything, but everyone's,
hey, I'm about married to one. I have to really press for it, for her to be like, you know, maybe this is the one. Like, for example, I was very proud of her when she loved The Graduate. I was like, this movie is older. It's not like super old, but it's older. Let's give it a shot. And she loved The Graduate. But if I showed her, you know, Citizen Kane, would she love Citizen Kane? I don't think the odds of that are very good.
Can you know what?
Love conquers all.
Which has George Hurst, who's dramatized in Citizen Kane.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, she's a big Hurst fan.
It's interesting. And sometimes it is when they offer some of those black and white movies in a colorized version, and unfortunately,
never.
It's never well done. And sometimes that's how I've had to even introduce it, just to get someone to shut up and watch the damn movie.
Most famous example, of course, being It's a Wonderful Life.
Yes.
Which is just,
man,
awful.
I remember my dad got that, like, I think as like a DVD, and he ejected it within 10 minutes and watched his old copy.
Way to go, Dad.
He's like, are you for real? And I remember they even tried doing it with the Three Stooges, who were big in the 30s and 40s. And that was the same kind of deal. It's like, I can understand the experimentation, but it was a cash grab. It just wasn't well thought out, whoever was doing the coloring.
Yeah, for sure. That's a hard thing to do.
It is. And it's just as bad as, you know, much like Walter Murch was doing with Touch of Evil, where you're having to literally play God with a movie. You're like, okay, the filmmaker has been long dead for, you know, three decades actually. And I'm trying to figure out how, you know, how they would have probably incorporated this. You know, here's my hunch. I could be just as easily wrong as anyone else.
Gosh, what was the Orson Welles movie that came out like 2 years ago?
In the Valley of the Wind or something like that.
The Other Side of the Wind?
Other Side of the Wind, Boganovich. Yeah. And that was another one I thought would never get released. It was kind of like that one movie Dennis
I think
Hopper.
He has like three movies like that still. They could do them if they wanted to. You just got to have the confidence to do the edit.
Oh, 1,000%. And basically five different filmmakers who got Time to Kill basically got to do all the funding and remastering in the lab.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's the other thing. They got to be in there all day and taking lunch breaks because they can't have anyone goof it up. Otherwise, they'll have to, you know, pay the estate for all the damage.
Yep.
And incur the wrath of online internet, you know, people who are like, what the fuck, dude? You had one job.
Totally.
And, but yeah, I mean, when I see people start off with like imitating tropes, is like, I still get many who are just oblivious. And even though they know about older movies, some of them only know about it if, say, there's a movie within a movie kind of formula. It's like, for real? I mean, I even knew about some of these classic kind of period pieces of films from reading film books and even just from watching Saturday morning cartoons. They would reference everything, you know?
Yeah. Well, then, yeah. I mean, like Pinky and the Brain, they had like an Orson Welles character on it.
Yes.
You know?
So if pop culture isn't good enough for you, then what is? It shouldn't be just a bizarre shot in something like, I don't know, LA Confidential or The Matrix to really make you understand. You should already kind of have that just down. I mean,
or even if you hear that, LA Confidential is basically a ripoff of all these other movies they love. And LA Confidential is a great movie.
It's
like all this other stuff too. If you like that movie, how about the stuff that influenced it? You know? Mm-hmm.
And so many people, it's a knockoff of, they only watched like the first movie it's labeled kind of as. And it's like, yeah, but there's so many other equators to that. You know, before Die Hard, you had all the 70s disaster movies by Irwin Allen. Then you had, you know, Dog Day Afternoon type hostage thrillers. And then you had, you know, even John Carpenter's Assault on Precinct 13, which again is a mashup of zombie and Western movie tropes in a crime.
Yeah, that's a hawk. That's Rio Bravo.
That's Rio Bravo. And yeah, I would have probably been at a loss had I not mentioned Rio Bravo. And even the original 3:10 to Yuma, I definitely see those formulas kind of referenced more than say something like Dragnet or The Fugitive. They are kind of just crystallized into any kind of film era because of how even Red River, I think, kind of is.
We're talking Hawks. I freaking love Red River. Yeah. I like Red River more than Rio Bravo. I don't know if that's a hot take or not, but I love
it. Isn't everything a hot take? But I know what you mean. It's like I see all three of those movies, especially, referenced the most in that it's like the easiest setup to put a good guy and a bad guy in the same room and share the screen for the most part, and then have to face off in either a gunfight, or the good guy has to use the anti-hero slash villain to find the main guy pulling the strings or something like that. Even movies, especially, I would see a lot of critics even do the Red River contrast when they were seeing a giant blockbuster that had two dynamite movie stars facing off on the big screen against each other. And I kind of miss some of that, because now when I see it, it's like, okay, I know one of those guys. I don't know the other guy because I don't watch this show.
So. Yeah, I mean, yeah, movie stars don't really exist in the same way they used to, for sure.
Yeah, because you can be hot 1 minute and then down the next. It's like,
it's not about the actor, it's about the IP.
IP, yes. Yeah. It's like, you can make a freaking movie off a TikTok star or YouTube critic, for God's sakes, and you would fucking get a movie. It wouldn't necessarily be a good movie. And some of them would even fess off afterwards. I don't know what I was doing. I'm like, I don't think anyone knew what they were doing.
Yeah, yeah.
Because you were looking at the big bucks and couldn't turn it down. And I get it. There is some stuff you just can't turn down.
But it's also, I mean, it's the studio mentality too. It's like, look, we can pay $2 million for the rights to this popular book, and then we'll have to pay the actor half as much as we used to pay Jim Carrey in the 90s or whatever, right?
Yeah. Oh, and I'm glad you mentioned that, because anytime I hear a podcast interview with someone who worked, you know, in the last four decades, they'll often even just be pretty crystal clear. They had very strict contracts, and it's like, yeah, but none of these contracts could have been anything near as bad as the 40s or 50s were basically.
Oh, no.
Is like,
where you're locked down for 8 movies, kid.
And act your age, kid. Don't take a smoke break, kid. And it's like, yeah, if you work at Warner Brothers, you cannot work at Universal or Fox. Or and if you did voiceovers for Disney, you were probably doing that near the end of your career, because you no longer had the movie star look, you know. And you just, but again, you had smoked 10 packs a day, so therefore
do you have favorite movie stars from this era?
Who are your
faves?
My favorites, so obviously you mentioned some good ones like Jimmy Stewart, and love Rita Hayworth. I know she's bigger in the 60s, but I love Claudette Colbert. I love, you know, I even don't mind Katharine Hepburn, even though nowadays I like to I often see everyone putting her on overrated movie stars, but I mean,
I like Katharine Hepburn. Again, Howard Hawks bringing up Baby, that's 30s, but God, she's good in that movie. Like, unbelievably good in that movie.
Totally. Jack Lemmon, there's freaking, I mean, Peter Lorre doesn't really do as much here as he did in the 30s, but I see plenty of others.
He's an unforgettable, yes, an unforgettable face and voice for sure. I love, Cary Grant, I think, is great. He's another one of those guys who's like, not sure how great of an actor he is, but he's a great movie star.
He basically worked on himself, which was, I'm going to be a likable dude.
Exactly. And he's even when I'm just a complete jerk off, like, I'm still likable. That's my thing.
If I'm a thief or a sailor, I'm still pretty cool. And just even seeing Audrey Hepburn, how she kind of just like does the whole shtick of, you know, just be eye catching in the movie, but then kind of get on the soapbox in the last 20 minutes. But she's pretty likable in the right movie. But I mean, then there's even freaking Vincent Price. I just, Man of a Thousand Voices. And it's just so wild how, like, all those other Hammer horror guys, he just keeps becoming bigger and bigger as his career goes on. But he starts kind of right here as just the moody, you know, witch doctor or the creepy voice guy. And there's a lot of good effects people. I'm trying to remember who was like a real key guy who like influenced everyone from Rick Bowden to Stan Winston. And I think you can still watch something like, well, that's kind of 60s, but you can even watch some of his earlier Harryhausen stuff, and even some of the Japanese filmmakers who would work on American productions outside of Godzilla and Kaiju type stuff. And you're just like, but these guys, you know, this was their shtick, and they're kind of a star in their own right, even though they're not an actual movie star.
And yeah,
I don't know if you watch Svengoolie, but I'll watch some very obscure kind of black and white that they'll feature on there, and it's like, I had no idea there were this many sequels to Universal, you know, monsters or other bizarre stuff that you look at now and you're like, oh, there's no way Rod Sterling or Gene Roddenberry didn't see that and get some ideas.
Yeah, for sure. And you mentioned some of the Asian films of this year. We'd be remiss if we didn't mention this is kind of the dawn of Akira Kurosawa, maybe the most influential director of all time. I mean,
you mentioned It's a Wonderful Life, but like Akira was like a perfect double feature with that. What does a man do when he's dying of cancer and just has nothing but, you know, a swing set and just being gracious of the moody life he's had?
Two people trying to find value in their existence in times of strife. Yeah.
Total strife. Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, Seven Samurai, one of the most influential films of all time, coming out in the 50s. Rashomon, another one of the most influential films.
I saw Rashomon again recently, and I was like, man, I love it even more now.
It's so good. It's just good. Like, some movies are like, you know what? This isn't overrated. It's just great.
It's immortalized. And
yeah,
you see Kubrick getting his start. I think Paths of Glory is his most underrated movie.
I love Paths of Glory. Love it. And I took a world military history class
college,
and he liked to show us movie clips to be like, all right, let me tell you how accurate this scene is. He said Paths of Glory, in his opinion, is the most accurate depiction of battle that he's ever seen in a movie, which I thought was crazy.
1,000%. And I think you could even say that Rashomon, you know, it gets more referenced even more than people even realize. They probably reference it, but they don't even realize they're referencing it.
But yeah, I mean, it came up last year with, what was the name of that movie? The Last Duel. I was like, oh yeah, it's like medieval Rashomon. And I was like, I guess that's kind of true. They're still doing it.
If it's not a pretentious CSI episode, then someone else is doing the Rashomon formula. I think it's good because I rewatched it about a few years ago, and it was one of those where it's like, okay, I know the story. I know it begins and ends, but now there's just other little layers to pick apart. Mm-hmm. So it's like a good crime show nowadays where, again, you figured out within the first 20 minutes which of the three suspects was doing what, but now there's that remaining 40 minutes where...
Yeah, it's all about the little details.
The little details. Okay, I knew you were at the crime. Why were you at the scene of crime? I knew you killed her. Why did you kill her? How did you kill her? And it's not easy to explain to some people. Unfortunately, everyone just, when I've interviewed even comedians on here, they've done the whole, I asked them, do you think some people just don't understand certain kinds of comedy or filmmaking? They're like, no, more often they've seen it all. You just had to get their attention. I think that's unfortunate because you like to think some movie, when you see people talking about a slow burn, you don't know if it's slow, but it's not, you know, great, or it's boring 1 minute, or it's just taking its sweet time. It's like that. There's so much terminology that just kind of goes out the window, and you're just like,
and they, to be fair, they can be boring, but they can also be so much more engaging, despite the fact that they're not, you know, throwing missiles at other large robots the entire film. It's like, let's sit with here and think about the human implications of what these people in the film are doing, and it's way more interesting than a beam going up into the sky and superheroes flying around or whatever.
And you can be more forgiving of a 40s or 50s movie that at least basically part of the pitch came from just an idea. It's like, hey,
yeah,
here's a guy who's a gangster at night and a reporter at day. Hey, here's a movie where a gal gets to be the greatest showgirl on the planet and becomes a beauty queen, and it's a musical. Then you see kind of some of that in the 80s or 90s, but you remember them more for just being half-assed mediocre movies with a great idea. And you're just like, but I can't watch this because the idea is just so poorly executed, while 40s and 50s kind of really relish the ideas. It's like they winged it, and it paid off, even if it was showing its age or bad print or slow in that first 20 minutes. It was worth
it. And it is, I mean, it is like the prime age for some of the greatest filmmakers of all time. I mean, I mentioned Howard Hawks. We've talked about Capra. Paulin Pressburger, I brought up. David Lean is making great movies during this era. Yeah. Brief Encounter is one of the great romance films ever made. Obviously, mm-hmm. Orson Welles is doing great work.
I'm still
Kubrick, like you said, is getting his start. Billy Wilder is putting out banger after banger during this era.
Billy Wilder is like, he's so well loved, and yet I still feel like, kind of like Norman Lear on the realm of TV, he doesn't get enough love. You're like, yeah, but that idea, that genuine idea, legit came from Billy Wilder.
Yeah, it's crazy. I mean, he was, we did a Billy Wilder series, probably about a, I guess a year ago by now, and on our podcast, and man, I mean, his like 10 best films can pretty much stand shoulder to shoulder with just about anybody. He made some great, great movies. Sunset Boulevard, probably my favorite Billy Wilder. That's a 50s movie.
If no one's ripping off the opening intro to Goodfellas, typically someone's taking a shot from Sunset Boulevard. And
yeah,
and now, unfortunately, it's been done so many times, you often can predict, let me guess, it's the dead man talking, isn't it?
Well, it is like, I mean, that's probably part of it too, is yeah, they've seen, you know, seen all the movies that influenced it. So when they see it for the, when it happened for the first time, they're like, oh, I've seen that before. That's tired. Whatever.
was, yeah. Just like they're trying to discern which cops and robbers movies are later in a giant blockbuster like Heat or Usual Suspects. They're watching Sunset Boulevard and they're like, oh, Brian De Palma ripped this off, didn't he?
Well, when you watch a De Palma movie, you're like, oh, that's from this Hitchcock movie. Got isn't it.
You bastard. it is just basically, like I say, it just reminds you what to be appreciative of. And when it just kind of calls some of the hackneyed screenplays out on their bullshit, it's just like, okay, I can understand a nod, but this is no longer a homage. This is a legit ripoff. And it's not easy. Like, I was even in a Orville podcast group, and some of them were getting really annoyed that people were calling it a ripoff or a parody. I'm like, well, it's got elements of those. You might consider it your legit own thing, but you clearly got too huge an ego if you're saying that.
You know, yeah. And it's fine for stuff to be influenced by other things. Again, we talked about Assault on Precinct 13. Yeah. I might like Assault on Precinct 13 better than Rio Bravo. Maybe. I mean, they're both great, but it
depends,
like,
on the day.
they can stand on their own and one be influenced by the other, you know?
Oh, for sure. And so once again, this has been Dynamite Conversation. Where can we find you on the interwebs?
Yeah. So you can find me on my podcast over at In Session Film. I do a show over there called Extra Film, where normally we do a director series where we cover a legendary director. Again, we've talked about Howard Hawks. We've done, like I said, Billy Wilder. We've also done like the Wachowskis and Steven Soderbergh. Nice. So we're covering all different kinds of directors over there. So just go search In Session Film. I occasionally write at InSessionFilm.com as well. If you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm on Twitter at Mr. J. Ledbetter. Thank you so much for having me on. This was great. It's so nice to, I feel like all we did was like crap on modern movies, but
I think it's just
when you're talking about older movies, sometimes you're like, you know, I don't know. They were kind of better in some ways. That's the thought I had when I was watching Rio Bravo, because I was watching it recently for my podcast, and I was just like, older movies might just be better than new movies. It might just be better. Or at least there's a reason that a lot of these movies have sustained over years and years and years. And a lot of the other ones haven't. But I will also say, like, I watch 100 new releases every year. And there's like 10 movies from the 40s in every year that have like sustained. So it's not really a fair comparison. But I mean, I love one movie I didn't mention. I just want to shout it out because I freaking love this movie. The Night of the Hunter.
Yes. Classic. Okay.
Love that movie. I'm currently staring at I have a Night of the Hunter poster right in front of me.
Oh, that's creepy.
I'm looking at it. Yeah, it's great. I mean, Spike Lee ripped off Night of the Hunter and Do the Right Thing. So, you know, great directors respect it.
Would that have been when the character is looking at upon the city?
It's the love and hate brass knuckles, gold knuckles that he has. And he literally like recites the dialogue from Night of the Hunter.
I'll give him a pass over Tarantino. Just can't keep his hands off.
Well, Tarantino is a remixer.
Yes, basically.
He's a DJ remixing the things he loves. Yes.
Okay. Oh man. So this has been a blast, and everyone, once again, keep your eyes peeled open for In Session Film.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. This was awesome.
Absolutely. I just needed a fun, let's sum up the eras. This is the time of year, instead of let's go for what franchises we haven't gone through. Let's sum up kind of some highlights that we would casually recommend viewers do.
Yeah, let's act really pretentious and snobbish for an hour. Yeah.
We'll return after these messages.
Do you ever find yourself thinking about who would win in a fight between Goku and Superman? Hi, I'm James Gavsey, and on the Who Would Win show, me and my co-host Ray ignore anything important happening in the outside world and debate fictional battles between characters from comics, movies, and video games.
We got a new show every week, and almost always am I the winner.
Yeah, not true, Ray.
In the past, we've discussed such matches as Captain America versus Darth Vader, Solid Snake versus the Iron Giant, classic matchups like RoboCop versus Terminator, and even the Muppets versus Sesame Street.
That one was crazy. So if you're a fan of geek culture and love a spirited debate, check out the Who Would Win show wherever you get your podcasts, or check us out at whowouldwinshow.com.
We let things pile up in the DVR. We add them to our queues. We wait for the DVDs and Blu-rays. We time shift. The Time Shifters Podcast. Sci-fi, horror, fantasy, superheroes, comedy, action, film, television, maybe some not-so-current events. Find us on iTunes or at timeshifterspodcast.com.
Cool thing about Blind Knowledge is we are in multiple countries. We are worldwide, all across the globe. We are in the US. We are in the UK. We are in Canada, Germany, India, Japan. We're in Australia, y'all. BlindKnowledge.com. Now back to the feature presentation.
Dragon Ball Z, One Piece, Naruto, all things that we love, all manga that were originally published in the legendary magazine Weekly Shonen Jump.
But not every series can run for 300 chapters and have a hit anime. This is David.
This is Jordan.
We're the hosts of Shonen Flop. Each episode we look at manga that ran in Jump that didn't quite make it.
We discuss what it did wrong, what it did right, how the series could have turned itself around, and ultimately, was it a flop or not?
Run all your favorite podcast apps, and you can find us at shonenflop.com.
Keep on flopping, floppers.
Follow us on the web on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The podcast is available on Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Anchor, Apple, and anywhere else podcasts are available. Feel free to review our show and leave comments on any of those sites. Thanks a million for listening. It's a jacked up.